This is Practical Software, the show that seeks out strategies, methodologies, and technologies that make software engineering projects succeed.
Hi folks, this is Sanjeev Nambudri here again with another exciting edition of Practical Software. We have another great guest lined up, Brian Kelly, who is the VP Engineering of Time Trade Systems. Welcome to the show, Brian. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Sanjeev.
I would like to introduce Brian, and a lot of what I'm saying here is based on what has been said about him in the forums that he writes in. So Brian has about 16 years of experience of building software, most of it spent creating distributed systems. He writes extensively about software engineering issues and about the Human Software Connect at his own blog, as well as for the Huffington Post online. Today we'll be talking specifically about how he led a move from a monolithic system to a microservices architecture. So first, the obvious question, Brian, what kind of monolithic system were you on earlier and what made you decide to make the change?
Sure. We were on a J2EE architecture using WebSphere as the application server container, and that really satisfied the business for many years. It was very easy to upgrade and update and consume from an operational standpoint. But at a certain point, our business demands and the feature requests that we were getting in engineering became so diverse and so frequent that we really felt hindered by this monolith. As every good sort of software engineering team, you know, they always want components to be individually updatable and for things to be migratable and testable in isolation. We were finding that it was getting harder to do all that with this large application server. So we led an effort to take some of those pieces of functionality out of that monolith, and also any new feature requests that came in, we would very strongly consider them being, you know, separate services, completely out of the application server and completely isolated and separated.
So I guess the next obvious question is, what were the biggest challenges at various stages of making that change, you know, right from creating the architecture to various stages of implementation and presumably as you had to maintain it going forward?
Yeah, there were plenty, and there were some growing pains that probably most companies who go through similar paths have similar issues. So, for example, the first time we did it, we took we had a project to implement calendar connectivity to Microsoft Exchange. So Time Trade, what we do is, a large part of it is appointment settings. So we have systems that create appointments. Well, obviously, if you create an appointment in Time Trade and you have a personal calendar like in Google or Exchange, you'd like that appointment to flow over to the calendar. Well, we took that functionality out into a separate container. Now, this is great, you know, in terms of being able to be agile around new calendar protocols and all that, but we were a little bit taken off guard by the amount of traffic that these kind of systems would have to handle. So just within a very short period of time, we had to scale that microservice very quickly. And we actually ended up rewriting the first version of it to completely overhaul its, you know, database access patterns and its internal concurrency architecture, all kinds of things. Because by virtue of us making it a microservice, it got more adoption because it just we were able to sell more of it and we were able to position it more in customer deals. And then it became a kind of victim of its own success. So the really good thing was we got some business value out of it. We hit that scalability limit very quickly. But the really good thing about having it isolated from the monolith was we were able to really quickly rewrite it and re-release it without having to overhaul the entire system that already existed.
Sure. Talking about the architecture itself, I mean, what would you say are the top considerations while you were designing the architecture for this kind of revamped approach?
Sure. The main thing is you need to understand your data flow and your data mastership. Because once you separate from a monolith, which typically has one big, enormous database connected to it, you then have to think very carefully about who owns data, how is data flowing from these components, and we ended up with hundreds of separate components. So it's very easy for us, a team, to understand a monolith because it's really just a small number of things. It's one big software server pointing at a database. But once you separate that into hundreds of individual components, each with their own database or database-like storage mechanism, then you have to understand really carefully at a high level who owns what data. Like, where is the master record for this particular thing? The other thing that we found was really important was knowing the difference between synchronous and asynchronous dependencies. So as an example, I'll use the Exchange connection example I just talked about. Sure. There's a big difference for time trade between looking up people's free busy time on their calendar versus looking up or versus actually booking an appointment and putting an appointment on the calendar. And here's the difference. It's a user experience difference. With free busy, if you look it up, you're doing that because somebody is trying to book an appointment and you want that to succeed within a matter of half a second at most, because people will abandon on the browser and they'll just give up if it takes too long.
Sure.
So the free busy lookup has to be synchronous. It has to be very fast, and it's a dependent synchronous service. But we initially had appointment booking after an appointment is booked, we had the sort of synchronous dependency on the booking and the placing of an appointment on a calendar. And then we realized it doesn't matter if that's asynchronous. It would actually be better if it's asynchronous because, you know, as long as we ensure the appointment makes its way to the calendar in a reasonable amount of time, the person who's, booked the appointment on the web browser, they've finished. They're gone. So we were able to get a lot of advantages by understanding what needs to be synchronous versus asynchronous.
Interesting. How about, and this might be an inaccurate question given what you said, but how is microservices architecture different from the older service-oriented architecture?
There's a lot of overlaps with service-oriented architecture, and I think I would characterize microservices as service-oriented architecture with, stripped down to the bone. It's service-oriented architecture without a lot of the overhead of frameworks or things that people really felt a little bit constrained by. So, in the days of web services, WS standards and SOAP and all that, you would have these very large bus frameworks or, request brokers, and they would really get in, really, sort of written into the heart of the system. And you ended up with a hub and spoke thing where you got this big broker in the middle that's fanning out requests, or it's distributing them, or it's routing them. And, there's goodness to that that's a reasonable thing to do. But then you end up with a monolith in the middle doing all the work that you were trying to avoid. So microservices, it's a reaction to that, where we took the good parts of SOA, which was, lots of components individually doing their own thing, but without necessarily having to buy a very expensive broker from an enterprise service bus company.
So how about upgrade of applications? I mean, how can they be upgraded without affecting the system? And, how could, for example, release patches be applied? So really, I guess what I'm asking is, on an ongoing basis, as the system or the product grows, how would that work in the microservices architecture?
Yeah, that's a really important point for this. So upgrading becomes both much more pleasurable and enjoyable, and it also becomes much more, I won't say dangerous, but, much, much more critical to add lots of care and monitoring around. So as an example, if you have a lot of microservices separated with a simple RESTful API and you maintain that API compatibility, then you can reasonably and pretty easily have an upgrade strategy for an individual component, and none of the other pieces should have to worry as long as there's complete compatibility with the API. And I mean that in terms not only of schema like JSON or XML, but also in terms of performance guarantees and behavior guarantees. All of those things have to be exactly like they were before. So you do have to have a good awareness of the coupling and the contract between those components. So, that's something that is just work that you have to do. The really difficult part becomes if you haven't separated your microservices properly, if they're depending on a shared service, like say they're all running over the same database server, then really you don't have microservices, you've got a database server with a lot of entry points, and that's a different thing. So you do need them to be individually migratable and upgradable. And the last thing I'll say on this is around scalability and how you upgrade for scalability. You can take a two-stack model. If you have a way of routing requests to microservices that is pretty sophisticated, then you can have existing requests, you know, flowing to version one of a microservice. Then you add version two onto the network, and you can flow some or all of your requests over to that, or you can switch over, and then you can have a fallback, you know, rollback strategy of just reversing the routing path and just go back to the old service. So because of the lightweight nature of the microservices, you get to do these kind of things, whereas if it was a monolith, the amount of work to upgrade the entire monolith is so much that being able to roll back a small part of it is very difficult, if not sometimes impossible. So all of those things come into play, and it definitely changes the landscape for upgrading.
Let's talk about security. How can you implement security across the application and between services without, say, for example, HTTPS certificates? How does all of that play out?
Sure. Well, we sell a lot to banks, so I spend most of my life in security scans and audits,
sure.
So it's something we're keenly aware of now. It's critical. You don't want your microservices to be a foothold for an attacker to add, you know, for an attack vector to appear because you added some microservice on the web and you forgot to properly secure it. If your microservices are all internal, in other words, you know, the only way in is through the regular web SaaS interface, then you can hide them behind firewalls and you can just completely restrict outside access. But if somebody does get into your system, you obviously don't want them to have full-on access to all of your services just by scanning the network ports on your internal network. So you can make a choice. You can either have complete authentication across all of your microservices, or you can leave them completely open if security is not a concern for you. And you can probably guess which one we choose. The important thing is for most of the transactions in a web SaaS system, they're going to be done on behalf of a user, someone who is logged in and has credentials, either basic auth or OAuth. Those credentials should flow through the microservices and should be applied and checked at every level. You know, just because somebody has made a request in the network does not mean that you should implicitly trust that request. You should have trust applied at every level. So we even go as far, you know, we have firewalls at every level and intrusion detection systems and all that. I mean, that might be overkill for some companies, but for us, you know, that's something we need to do. But certainly, if you're not careful, microservices could be a way to regress and reduce your security by developers jumping on the flexibility and saying, oh, this is great, we can just throw all these components on the network. Well, that could be a real dangerous thing if you're not careful.
Sure, the weakest link kind of scenario.
Exactly, yeah.
So last question, Brian, I guess, what would be, I think, your, say, top two reasons you would recommend people to move to microservices? And say the top two in your mind, red light, you know, which stop people from doing so.
Top reason is if you have a development team and a feature set of requirements that would be really suited to building a mashup of your features. I know of a variety of companies that have done this. They said, you know, we want to pivot our company just a little bit, and we want to attack this different market or this different kind of demographic. So we just need to tweak some of the features. If you find yourself doing that, maybe you should take those features and extract them into microservices to give you that flexibility. If you're not in that situation, then I would say, you know, carry on doing what you're doing if it's working for you. The big red light is around operational concerns and DevOps and the ability to change from a very simple architecture, which is a big monolith connecting to one big database. If you're able to change from that to perhaps hundreds or maybe even thousands of individual components, then good for you. But that is a big investment in infrastructure, monitoring, security. it's a lot for an operations team to consume if they haven't been prepared for that. So it can be kind of a hidden cost at the start of the development cycle that might not be evident at the outset.
Thank you so much, Brian. I'm sure that our listeners will, you know, value this conversation and this introduction to the microservices architecture. I just wanted to ask you before we leave that, do you recommend any blogs, any sites on the internet where our listeners can get more information about the stuff that you've talked about today?
Yeah, there was a really good introduction done by Netflix, who went through a similar thing a few years ago as well. And they put up a variety of blog posts on that on their developer blog. And they're very forthcoming with their information. They obviously handle tremendous scale. They also have links further on. And I think that would be a really great place to start. And, you know, for any DevOps concerns and operational understanding, a great place to start is the Phoenix Project, which is a fictional novel about the world of DevOps. And it's very entertaining.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Brian. It was wonderful talking to you. I'm sure our listeners would enjoy this introduction to MicroStrategy. On behalf of everybody at Practical Software, thank you for your time. And that's all, folks. Great show this time. Hope we have another great guest just as forthcoming with information. Bye, Brian, and thank you for giving us your time.
My pleasure. Thank you, Sanjeev.